Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Thanks, Marshall. Today on Off Script, I'm thrilled to have as my guest one of the most accomplished lyricists and authors of the Broadway musical, Tony, Drama Critics, Olivier, Outer Critic, Grammy and Emmy, as well as Academy Award and Golden Globe nominee, Lynn Ahrens. With her composer collaborator Stephen Flaherty, Lynn has either written lyrics or both book and lyrics for Ragtime, Seussical, My Favorite Year, and A Man of No Importance, one of my favorites, and Once on This Island, that won the Tony for Best Musical Revival last year, and both the animated film and musical Anastasia, now on Broadway. Currently, Lynn's working on Marie, formerly known as Little Dancer, that will premiere with her revised book at the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle this spring. Welcome, Lynn.
Hi, thank you.
There's so much to cover with the career that you've had, but so many people in the theater come to New York with hoping to realize their dreams of the theater. And to go way back just for a minute, you started out in New York with a pretty ordinary office job.
Yes, I did.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, that ordinary little office job was really what I think started me on a career path. I came to New York just wanting to be in New York. That was really my goal. I love New York, and I was born here, and just knew I wanted to live there. So I came, and I took the first job that was offered, which was as a secretary in an advertising agency. And, you know, I did the usual secretarial things that girls right out of college do. I made coffee, and I typed, and all that good stuff. But I also, at that point, was writing songs on the guitar, which was something I had started to do in college. And so on my lunch hours, I would bring my guitar into work, and I would strum and write songs. And one day, one of the creative directors of the agency, a guy named George Newell, peeked into my little cubicle area and said, would you like to try a song for a show we're producing called Schoolhouse Rock? And I knew about the show because I worked at the agency that produced it, but, you know, to be offered a chance to write a song for real, a professional song, was just like lightning from the sky. And I said, of course. And that led to my becoming one of the mainstay writers and singers of that animated show, which is quite famous now and, you know, has raised generations and generations of kids on grammar and math and history and all sorts of things. So that was the beginning of a songwriting career right there. And in about 5 years, I realized that I could probably support myself as a songwriter, and so I quit my job. I by that time, I was a full-fledged copywriter and a creative supervisor, but I just thought I wanted to be a songwriter, and I went off to try it.
And how did you make the switch from writing for television to writing for the stage?
Well, I wrote jingles for commercials mm-hmm. for many years, which was great fun, and I sang them, and, you know, I did things like Bounty the Quicker Picker Upper and What Would You Do for a Klondike Bar and all these rather well-known.
You did Klondike Bar?
I did. I was the voice. I was that
wow.
little voice. Yes, that was me. but at a certain point, and I also got into writing television shows, so I began to produce what they call drop-in television shows, create them and produce them. They're short-form shows that go in between. They're interstitials. They go in between the full-length programs. And I was producing those and writing songs for those and doing Schoolhouse Rock and doing jingles. And somebody said, wow, you've done everything there is to do in songwriting, but you've never tried writing for the theater. And there's this workshop that you would love. It's called the BMI Musical Theater Workshop, and you might want to consider it. And a friend of mine said that to me. And so I applied. You have to audition. I auditioned, and I got in, and I joined the workshop. And the first year I was in it, I met Stephen Flaherty, who was this young, shy, rather backwards composer socially. He couldn't look you in the eye. It was really funny. And we started writing together, and it's been 35 years.
Let me ask about that, because you know, there are some marriages, they all don't have to be, you know, spousal, but there are some teams, collaborations that are just meant to be. When did you sense in Flaherty that you would have such a, as it were, a lifelong partner in writing the, for the musical theater?
I can't say that I did.
It wasn't love at first sight?
Well, it was it was musical love at first sight.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yes, it was. It was. I mean, I had no idea it would last this long or that I would even ever do one show, you know. But I did enjoy his music so much, and I loved his sensitivity to lyrics. And part of that is because he was, at that time, writing his own lyrics. And I was, of course, writing my own music. So we both sensed what the other one did, and we're very good at collaborating in that sense because we understand both sides of it.
Yeah. In case you've just joined us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. And my guest today is Lynn Ahrens, multi-Tony Award-winning book author and lyricist for musicals that you might have heard of, like Ragtime. Before we go further, for the people who are not involved in the theater, because you do both and you are the metaphoric horse's mouth here, the voice of authority, explain basically to people who aren't professionals in the theater the difference, what you mean when you say a book as opposed to lyrics.
Oh, sure. Well, a book, or it's also called a libretto, is anything that's spoken, and it functions as the sort of the bare bones of the piece. It's the structure of the musical. It goes from beginning to the end of the first act and into the second act, and you have to figure out where it's going to start, where it's going to end, and what happens in between. And then it's the dialogue that the actors say, or monologue. It's any spoken word hung on that skeleton, and then the songs are what flesh it out, and you know, the lyrics are sort of the bridge between the music and the spoken word. So,
while we're on that topic, do you think the distinction between the book and the songs has become more blurred in recent years? In terms of, because a lot of people, you know, we hear a lot these days about the sung-through musical.
Right.
And it's sort of for the average person, I think that might blur the distinction. I mean, do you think there is a distinction that's valid?
Well, everything is story. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a song or whether it's somebody speaking a scene, it's all part of the story and it all needs to serve the story. I think that's where modern musicals are different than, you know, a lot of the musicals that were done in the 50s where a song was an entertainment that was plopped in there and, you know, a wonderful production number or something. And now it really has to be in some way revealing of character, or it has to tell the story, or you know, it has to move us from one point to another point dramatically. So I think that's really the difference. I think book and lyrics are certainly separate, but they intertwine now in a much more unique and you know, tight way.
Right. You've been affiliated with so many great musicals. The most popular, naturally, is Ragtime. How did you get involved, because it had been a best-selling popular novel by Yael Del Toro, how did you team up and get involved in that project?
For that, I just did the lyrics. Terrence McNally, the great playwright Terrence McNally, I always, you know, call him the great master, he did the book,
right?
And Stephen Flaherty wrote the music, so we were a little creative team. We were basically invited to join that project by the producer, Garth Drabinsky, who at that time was producing in America, and he's a Canadian producer who, that's another interview.
Okay.
But, he's a very special person and a creative dynamo, and he had optioned E.L. Doctorow's wonderful novel, and so, and was putting together a musical, and he invited us all to do it.
Once on This Island, first produced back in 1990, and then, of course, it was revived last year to great acclaim and awards last year.
Yes.
When you first saw your work produced in 1990 and were satisfied with it, I guess, did you ever envision that it would be completely re-envisioned?
No.
Almost 30 years later?
Yeah, it was quite a thrill, really, and a surprise to see this most recent production. We Once on This Island was our first Broadway show. We had done an off-Broadway show before that called Lucky Stiff. That was our first production at Playwrights Horizons, and then we did Once on This Island also for Playwrights Horizons, but it moved to Broadway. So that was our first experience on Broadway, and it was the most beautiful production. The original production was pristine and beautiful and joyous. It was directed and choreographed by Graziella Danielle, and we just loved it. And it was, from beginning to end, the most joyous and beautiful experience. And it was a long run on Broadway at that time. And
in the West
great.
End, it got the Olivier.
It got the Olivier right. for best musical in right. the West End. And, you know, it was just the little show that could. It was just a wonderful show, and it now gets produced in every school in America and all across the world. You know, there are productions of it every year, lots of them. But we never thought it would be back on Broadway, ever. And when Michael Arden, the director, came to us a few years ago and said he had a vision for this show that he wanted to pursue, we very hesitantly said yes, after some thinking and after several meetings with him to try and figure out what he was thinking, because, you know, we were taking something that was beloved and successful and handing it over to a rather young and untried director who'd only had one Broadway show. And, you know, we just didn't know what he was going to do really with it. And it was a little leap of faith. And what it turned out to be was this immersive production where you came into this theater in the round and your feet were in the sand, and, you know, there it was.
And
it
the goat is going up and down the theater aisles.
It's going up and down. There's live goats and live chickens, and we're like, what's happening? But it was fantastic, and the cast was extraordinary. I just had a cup of coffee yesterday with our choreographer, Camille A. Brown, who is a brilliant young choreographer who is shooting like a meteor right now. And what she brought to it was stunning. And it was quite a wonderful reconceiving of something that we thought we knew inside and out. And it was totally different.
So Once on This Island, did you do both book and lyrics?
I did for that.
So, okay, with something like Ragtime, you did lyrics. Terrence McNally did the book. With Once on This Island, you did book and lyrics. How is it different when you do both? Do you have a sense of more control when you're doing both book and lyrics? Is it easier to write song after you've written the character in full? How do you approach?
That's a really interesting question. Well, first of all, it's one less person to have an argument with, you know,
because you can have plenty, but with yourself.
I can tell myself exactly what to do, and then I do it.
Right.
It's for me, it's easier to write book because I'm in control of the structure, and I am very good at structure, I think. I mean, I think I understand it, and I enjoy it. So I'm always puzzling that out, and I love that part of it. The songwriting is a little bit harder because for example, with Terrence McNally, when I'm working with him, what he writes, for instance, he gives me a monologue that's a page long, and it's beautiful. It's filled with beautiful language and beautiful imagery, and I can see the song leaping right out of those words. But when I'm writing lyrics and book, I have to write those lyrical passages to allow myself to write the lyrics. And, you know,
this is a naive question. When you're writing from somebody else's book, does that mean you're adapting his book lyrically for a song, or are there occasions where the book might need some new lyrics, you then insert lyric?
You can do both. And you know, a lot of times I ask Stephen for music first, because music is the emotion and lyrics tend to be the intellect of a song. And if he just gets some little emotional vamp under his fingers and goes to the piano and plays it, immediately a song appears to me.
So collaboration is really key. I mean, if you're getting to a lyric and you've got to take a character from A to B at a certain point in the structure of the story, and the book's not there, doesn't it depend on the nature of the relationship you have with the book writer to go back and say, hey, I need a better lead in here to make this song work?
It's a constant collaboration. Sometimes with myself and Stephen, sometimes with myself, a book writer, and Stephen. And it's a constant give and take between words and lyrics and music. And, you know, sometimes we need a little more music to accommodate what the director needs. And sometimes we need more words to lead into the song more gracefully. And sometimes the lyrics have to accommodate what's being said in the scene that can be more interesting in the lyrics or whatever. So it's you're constantly going back and forth with each other. Right. It's a fascinating process. It's hard to describe it because it's like, it's just very intuitive, really, more than anything.
This is a dumb question. Seussical, Ragtime, my favorite year, Once on This Island, Anastasia, a lot of lyrics, a lot of book writing. Do you have a favorite?
No.
Good answer.
No.
All right. Well, okay. Not of a production. Let me ask the question in a different way. Do you have a favorite song of all of those?
No, okay. I have a number of favorite songs, and each of the musicals for me, some are better than others. Some are unfulfilled a little bit. Some are I wouldn't touch a word.
Mm-hmm.
Some I keep tinkering with, but each one of them I think is so special to me because they each happened at a different point in my life.
Right.
And so what I've expressed in each one of them, it's interesting to me actually to look back and see my progression as a person through those shows.
So when you went back and revisited Once on This Island, Did you just let it say what it said 25 years before? Or did you go in and say, well, this could be tweaked a little, and so you did?
The only thing, we really didn't tweak anything. There was one tiny little scene where Ti-moon, the heroine, finds the boy that she's in love with, first finds him. And that was just a little scene, and I thought, oh, this should have a little music there. Actually, Michael Arden suggested that, you know, just maybe there's something
romance
to be sung, just a little pinch. And so we did that, and because of the new choreographer and Camille A. Brown's kind of choreography, Stephen redid some of the dance music that was there originally. That's all pretty new. But, you know, basically, I have to say that show is perfect in terms of structure. It's perfect three-act structure. It's pretty much through composed. It pretty much starts singing at the beginning and ends with singing. It never stops singing.
It's joyous. It's a wonderful fable.
I wouldn't touch it.
I loved it.
Thank you.
I was totally charmed by it.
Thank you.
In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer, and I'm talking to Lynn Ahrens, among many other awards, winning shows. Lynn is best known for Ragtime, as well as Anastasia, that's now on Broadway, and Once on This Island, that just closed after a Tony Award-winning revival run. Lynn, we were talking before about the process and how things evolve when you're working on a musical, and I wonder if we could talk a little bit about Marie.
Sure.
Formerly known as Little Dancer.
Correct.
By way of background, you've done both book and lyrics. Mm-hmm. The music is by
Stephen Flaherty. Yes.
Good. And it premiered at the Kennedy Center
Washington. That's right. And it's directed and choreographed by Susan Stroman, the great Susan Stroman. So that's, yes.
Just for those who might not know who Susan Stroman is, just if you could mention for us some of her highlights.
Oh, well, The Producers, Contact, those are both multi-Tony winning shows. You know, I could go on.
So there's a lot of talent involved in this. Yeah. And it came out of Washington with, fairly say, a kind of, well, you looked at some of it and you said some of this is worked and maybe some of it didn't work. The point I'm getting to is you reworked the book.
Yes, but I will say that at the Kennedy Center, it was so shockingly successful. We didn't know what we had.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's the question. Why didn't it go further and why is it going further now?
Well, every show, you know, wants to happen in the right time, in its own time. Some reveal themselves, they open like flowers and they're just done and you move forward with them. With this show, Marie, we all felt that
we should probably stop and tell people just basically what it's about in case they're not familiar with Little Dancer.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
The show's title is Marie, and Marie is the name of the girl who posed for the famous Degas sculpture. And we are
the one with the frayed. She's a skinny little girl with the frayed, pauperish tutu
and cloth tutu. But it's a sculpture,
right.
And that figure appears in many of the world's greatest museums. It's at the Met. It's at the National Gallery in Washington. It's at the Musée d'Orsay. There are, you know, bronze casts of that figure all over the place, and so the musical is, I saw the sculpture at the Clark Institute, which I'm sure you know, which is in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and they have one of the figures there. And I have seen her a number of times, but a few years back I was looking at her again, and there's always a young girl having her photograph taken in fourth position next to the sculpture. And I started wondering who that girl was who posed for the sculpture. This is how ideas happen to writers. And I remember I was driving home in the car with my husband, and I said, you know, that girl, who was she? I wonder, there's something about that world that's so beautiful. And I started researching, and I discovered this, that who she was, her name was Marie von Goethem. I know quite a bit about her actual family, but there's really very little known about her, and she disappeared into the mists of history. There's no record of her, a marriage or a death or anything. She just was dismissed from the ballet at a certain point and vanished. And it's an intriguing story. And we decided to write a show, and it's an original musical, which it's not adapted from anything except our own brains.
It's your idea.
Yes.
Yeah, it's your idea.
Yeah, okay, I'll take that.
Good.
And we decided to, you know, sort of imagine her relationship with this great artist. How did it come to be? How did their paths cross? What did he see in her? How did she react to him? We think she was a scrappy little street kid, you know. And how did the sculpture that he made of her affect her life? And that is pretty much what the musical is about. It's following the course of her journey from young student ballerina to someone who becomes a featured dancer and what happens thereafter.
So how did it not go further 5 years ago or so, and why is it coming further now?
We in order to get to where we are now, every musical tells you what it needs. This said, I need to be shorter, and I need to have more about Degas and Marie and less about the secondary characters. The world is so rich. We musicalized everything the first time around. We had two songs for the older sister, Antoinette, who was really her older sister. We had a song for her younger sister, Charlotte, who was really her sister. We had several songs for her mother. We had songs for one of the gentlemen from the ballet. We had songs all over the place. And you know, sometimes in musicals they say you have to kill your babies.
Mm-hmm.
And we killed a lot of babies. We said these songs don't merit, the characters don't merit this much stage
time. Get in the way of the structure.
Yeah, and exactly. And we need more stage time with our two fascinating main characters. So that's what we did. And of course, you know, the other thing is that between then, the Kennedy Center and now, we've had 1, 2, 3 shows on Broadway that we have had commitments for. Stroh has probably had, you know, 12 shows. We all are busy, and so things happen when schedule permits, and now we're ready to enable. We've cleared. Anastasia is up and running. Once on this Island won the Tony. Rocky came and went, and we'll be coming back, you know.
And in the meantime, you went to Spain to put the Spanish version of Anastasia on the road. And to Stuttgart.
And to Schenectady to start the national tour. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that has been in the way of just getting it on the schedule.
I want to conclude about Marie, but talk a little bit about someone in Spain or in Germany taking your book, mm-hmm. and taking your lyrics, and how you ensure that in translation it comes out to mean what it's supposed to mean and do for the structure of the story what it's intended.
Right.
How do you do that?
With great difficulty.
It must be a really, really
process. It's a little tedious, but it's actually interesting, and it gives me a little taste of other languages, which mm-hmm. I love. Like, we did Rocky in Germany, and we premiered it there. So I premiered a show in a language I do not speak.
Right. So you're getting a back translation. What do they call that?
It's a back translation. Is basically they give you the German or the Spanish or the French or whatever it is, and then they give you the words in English that the foreign words literally mean. And you can tell pretty much if it's close enough to the meaning you intended or if it's not close at all. And for example, when we did the Spanish translation, was given the Spanish translation of Anastasia, and I had written certain things that the translator completely misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Like, there are broken images, rain against a window, sheets upon a bed, terrifying nurses whispering overhead. These are like fragmented memories. And it came back, satin sheets, terrified girls, I don't know.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens.
It was so different. And I was like, this is not right. So it was a very, very, very lengthy back and forth and, you know, all of that stuff. But in general, I enjoy it. I really do enjoy it. And I'm pretty good at hearing languages because it's all about sounds.
Right.
And so, I can actually usually sing the songs in the foreign language. I know enough about pronunciation.
So as a you're talking now about the rhythm of
mm-hmm.
language. So
yes.
That's where being a composer helps, I should think.
That's exactly right. Because I can sing and I can sing the syllables and I can actually tell the translator, you have too many syllables in this phrase. And then they give me a hard time. No, 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 that's how we do it. No, 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 you have too many syllables. It's not going to sound good.
Last couple of questions. Let's get back to Marie. Talk about, if you will, the casting. The choreography, because it's so important.
It's set in the dance world. Well, First of all, let me talk about the cast. So playing the part of Marie von Goethem is New York City Ballet's premier dancer, Tyler Peck. She's a principal dancer. She is stunning, absolutely stunning. She does it all. She dances magnificently, and we knew that, but we didn't know what an actress she was. She can carry songs. She's a stunning, stunning performer.
This is not her first musical theater, is
she,
it?
Well, she was in, was it Oklahoma or Music Man?
Okay.
I'm forgetting.
That's okay.
I think it was Oklahoma with Stroh.
Okay.
And when she was a kid, when she was about 11 years old or something. And Stroh actually, this is Susan Stroman, that's what we call her, Stroh. She noticed a great deal of talent in this little girl and suggested that she take ballet lessons, and look at what happened. So she credits Susan Stroman with, you know, encouraging her to go in the direction of ballet. But she's a dramatic actress. I mean, she's absolutely stunning. So she's our star. We have the great Louise Petra, who you may remember from, she was the original mother in Mamma Mia. Tony nominated Force of Nature, who is playing adult Marie. She's playing Marie 40-some years later. We have Terrence Mann, who is playing Degas, who is so brilliant. Three-time Tony nominee. He's just a wild man. You know, he has all of the mercurial qualities that I think Degas had.
And the quirky intellect. Yeah.
The quirky intellect. Yeah. The humor and the wit, because Degas was very witty, and Terry is just hilarious, yeah.
And the choreography is Stroh, going to do a kind of a period interpretation of dance or ballet?
I would say that it's a modern interpretation of classical ballet, because the ballet is used, dance is used, I won't even say ballet, it's dance, and it's used not only to transition from scene to scene in these magnificent ways, but also to tell story. And there's a 10-minute ballet at the end that actually imagines what might have happened to this girl who vanished into the mists of history, right? So it's a very, very organic piece set in the backstage world of the Paris Opera Ballet in 1881, which is when the sculpture was created. And it's this magnificent world. The costumes are by William Ivy Long, who's like...
Oh, fabulous.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Yep, yep.
World premiere costume designer. The sets are by Beowulf Borrett. And everything about the show is stunning. That's all I can say. And I couldn't be happier to be.
And you will be there in Seattle to tweak it and
absolutely.
As
That's
it goes
the fun.
Along. Well, we hope to see you back with it on Broadway.
Yeah, me too.
Which is the point, I think, of taking it out to Seattle.
Well, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, the point really, when all is said and done, we never think about what's next for a show. We just don't. We think about what's now for the show and what's going to make it just great now for Seattle. You know, I've never been to Seattle, so I'm very excited to go. And we understand that their audiences are wonderful, very engaged theater goers. So, you know, we're going to be looking at them and seeing what they think.
Very sophisticated town.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
I can't wait.
Lynn,
I hope I fit in.
I think you will just... Anyway, Lynn, thank you very much. This
thank
has been
you.
A thrill to have you on Off Script. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Again, the show's been Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. My guest has been Lynn Ahrens, Tony Award-winning lyricist and book writer for plays that you might have heard of, like Ragtime and Anastasia Now on Broadway, and the upcoming Marie that will have its revised premiere in Seattle this spring. Until the next time, thanks for listening. And as a dear departed friend of mine used to say, until we see you again, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.